Theodore Roosevelt, in his 1914 autobiography, reminisced about his early days spent ranching on the western frontier in the Dakota Badlands. In the opening paragraph of a chapter entitled In Cowboy Land, T.R. wrote, "It was still the Wild West in those days, a land of vast silent spaces, of lonely rivers, and of plains where the wild game stared at the passing horsemen. We worked under the scorching midsummer sun when the wide plains shimmered and wavered in the heat, and we knew the freezing misery of riding night guard round the cattle in the late fall roundup. In the soft springtime, the stars were glorious in our eyes each night before we fell asleep, and in the winter we rode through blinding blizzards when the driven snow dust burned our faces. There were monotonous days as we guided the trail cattle or the beef herds hour after hour at the slowest of walks, and minutes or hours teeming with excitement as we stopped stampedes or swam the herds across rivers treacherous with quicksands or brimmed with running ice. We knew toil and hardship and hunger and thirst, and we saw men die violent deaths as they worked among the horses and cattle or fought in evil feuds with one another. But we felt the beat of hardy life in our veins, and ours was the glory of work and the joy of living." Roosevelt scholar Clay Jenkinson recalls a time when preeminent Roosevelt biographer Edmund Morris, after reading that passage at the end of a lecture, said to his audience, "I wonder if you Yanks will ever produce another president who can write something like that." The likely answer is no, there will not be another like Theodore Roosevelt. He often remarked to friends that he considered himself to be a, quote, literary fella, end quote. In fact, he wrote or co-authored over 40 books and hundreds of journal and newspaper articles. And though he earned modest government salaries in his years in public service, whether as U.S. Civil Service Commissioner, New York City Police Board member, Governor of New York, or even as president, for his entire life, it was as an author that he earned his living and paid his family's bills. Today's episode examines this often overlooked aspect of Roosevelt's life as a reader and a writer. Hello, and welcome to the Talk About Teddy podcast, weekly conversations exploring the world of Theodore Roosevelt. I'm your host, Kurt Skinner, and I'm normally joined by my good friend and co-host, Larry Marple. But this week, Larry was unable to make it, but I promise that he'll be back next episode. Today, I have a terrific conversation with literary scholars Thomas Bailey and Catherine Joslin, authors of one of my favorite TR books. Their 2018 Theodore Roosevelt, A Literary Life examines how TR's strenuous life is reflected in his tremendous accomplishments as an author and how his relationship with the written word is essential to the understanding of the heart and the soul of Theodore Roosevelt. Thomas Bailey is Professor Emeritus of English and Environmental Studies at Western Michigan University. Catherine Joslin is also Professor Emerita of English at Western Michigan and is the author of Jane Addams, A Writer's Life, and Edith Wharton and the Making of Fashion, which was a winner of the Choice Outstanding Academic Title Award. Tom Bailey and Catherine Joslin, welcome to the Talk About Teddy podcast.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Thank you for inviting us. We're very happy to be with you.
Thanks for making this time. Appreciate it. Been looking forward to this for some time. As you are well familiar, there are thousands of Theodore Roosevelt books, biographies out there written on any number of aspects of his life. You have collaborated on this look at Roosevelt as an intellectual. I was curious, how did you come to write this book? What sparked your academic interest in Theodore Roosevelt from a literary perspective?
Well, I'm a literary scholar, and I started with, I've done a lot of work on Edith Wharton. And as you may know, Edith Wharton grew up along with T.D. Roosevelt in the Gilded Age in old New York. They come from similar families. And then I went on from that. I was looking for a person who wasn't known as a literary figure, but was a literary figure. So I wrote about Jane Addams, the Settlement House founder, who founded Hull House in 1889. And she has a dozen books. And Spirit of Youth in the City Streets, everybody should read. And so I worked with her for a while, and I tried to figure out how to talk about somebody who wasn't usually talked about as a literary figure in American literature. And then I thought, after I did that book, I thought, well, maybe I should do a boy. And so I thought, oh, what boy would you choose if you were, had done Theodore Dreiser and such, but what man links Edith Wharton with Jane Addams? And I thought, okay, I'll try for that. And the truth is, I came up with Theodore Roosevelt because he had grown up in old New York with Edith Wharton, shared her political ideas all the way through his life. And but he wound up at the Bull Moose Convention a progressive. And therefore, he asked, Jane Addams is the first woman to ever speak at a national conference, and she seconded his nomination because he had become a progressive. So I thought, okay, well, I can link the one woman with the other woman, and I'll just do Theodore Roosevelt. Like that would be simple. And then I went and got his books out, and I realized how many books were there. And then I did what I sometimes do when I'm in trouble. I called downstairs to Tom, and I said, oh, Tom, I have a project I'm working on. I wonder if you might like to work along with me.
And I said yes, because I'm always supposed to say yes. And I get the desperate call, right? So I said yes, and I didn't know what I was getting it for either. And then we went to Harvard, and we started dealing with the wonderful people at the Harvard Library. And they said to us, this book needs to be written. Nobody's had the sheer
courage.
Well, courage, I suppose that's a word for it. The sheer courage to undertake it, because there's so much. And then they started bringing out these books and piling them up on the carrel that they've given us. And it came to something like 46 or 47 books. And we had read some already, but we started in and we plowed in. And an awful lot of reading had to be done before we could start writing.
And then we split,
3 or 4 years work.
And then we split it up. So I was doing the stuff as the boy, and we went to the Houghton Library. And now if you want to get things, the Dickinson State is digitizing the stuff. But also we went to the Library of Congress, and we read the papers. And I was really interested in the kid. So I said, Tom, why don't you take the old guy? Why don't you get him later? So Tom picks him up sort of after the presidency.
Well, during the presidency and afterwards. Yeah, and I was an English teacher and a literary scholar, although not as successful as Catherine. And I was, at the time, just finished up a stint as director of environmental studies at Western Michigan University. So I knew about John Muir, and I knew about John Burroughs, and I knew about the Homestead Act, and I knew about all the conservation stuff that Roosevelt was so interested in when he was president, right? I hadn't read the Africa book, nor had I read the Brazilian Wilderness book. But when I read those, I was very excited, and I knew this was a real project. It had meat to it, and it was important by its very nature. And we were delighted then to work on the writing of it for 2 or 3 years, right?
So what would happen is I would do this stuff on the little boy in the morning, and Tom would barrel into this man in the morning, and we'd come down for lunch, and I'd say, what a wonderful kid. I could expect a lot from this boy. He's sensitive, and he's smart, and he cares about language. And Tom would be all grumpy, and he'd say, I don't know, where does he get these political ideas? And so it was a weird disconnect.
Well, his tone is so admonitory, right? It's a wonderful tone, and when you get used to it, it's very compelling. But it doesn't fit with the modern sensibility very much, right?
You write that he had this life spent filling each moment with language. So, Catherine, you worked on him as a youth. I was going to ask you, what were some of these habits of youth that led to this life of words?
He was taught to write letters, and as soon as he could figure out letters, he wrote letters. And then he got excited about writing itself. And he would come up with, he'd give, he was already were doing plays, and he'd have the names of all the journals, the stories with all the names of the characters. And then, like, who was that supposed to be for? Everybody knew who the characters were. So he was already writing for an audience he might not have known the audience he would have. But so he would write journals, and he would draw pictures, and he put pen to paper every day in this really wonderfully earnest way.
Yeah, and his parents traveled around a lot, and the kids usually stayed home, or they went with one parent and not with the other. And Theodore wrote all these very charming letters to his mother. They're just lovely. And he wrote a different kind of letter to his father, who was a different kind of an audience, right? And they were charming in their own way, right? And he read all the time.
Had the access to that wonderful library.
He was nearsighted, you know, and so he was reading, but he was writing. And the question is, all along, who's he really talking to? And he has in mind this wider audience, even as a child. And you were interested in his early interest in nature.
I was going to ask to what extent that early nature interest would later influence his literary life.
He would go out and he was interested in birds. He was really a faunal naturalist is what he was. But he would go out and sit carefully, and he didn't know about his vision problem, and he would listen to bird song. And then he would try to craft the bird song so that he could remember it. And he would do journals on birds. And then he had a collection of birds that he would capture and, of course, kill and gut. And then he would measure everything in the bird to understand it better. And you can still see those birds at the Museum of Natural History in New York. His father had been one of the two donors to start the museum. And the second acquisition was this Museum of Natural History. And you can go there as a scholar. We did it. And they'll open the drawers, and the very birds that he worked with are right in front of you.
Right in front of you. Yeah. Right. And he studied taxidermy with the guy who had been taught taxidermy by John James Audubon. He could see up close because he was nearsighted, so he could read, and he was a really remarkable sketcher. Mm-hmm. So his sketches of birds and mice and stuff are, on the one hand, utterly charming, straightforward things that he did, and on the other, extraordinarily carefully observed. So when his daddy finally figured out there was something with his eyes and they got him glasses, he walked outside on to Fifth Avenue, and he looked up at the trees, and there were leaves on the trees. He could see, and that really drove him, it didn't drive him away from books and language, but it drove him outdoors in a new kind of a way, right? And it made his interest in the natural world so much more vivid, right?
Yeah, my wife talks about having that same experience as a kid, not getting glasses until, you know, later in childhood, and then looking up and understanding you can literally see the individual leaves on trees. And what I took that for granted as a kid. But it was a revelation to her.
It was when he was 14, I think, and he got a gun, and then he got the glasses. I think they went to Egypt.
Right, yeah.
And so, yeah, the whole world opened up. Pretty literally so.
Yeah.
He was interested. He was fascinated by every part of the birds he was studying, what they sounded like, and then to open them up and figure out how they were built and what they were made of. He was fascinated by that study. The first book that he writes later when he's in college. It's in 1877, The Summer Birds of the Adirondacks. And he goes through and then tries to put that bird that he was seeing and feeling and touching and dealing with into prose. Okay. Want me to read a piece?
Oh, certainly. Loved that.
Okay. So this is about the hermit thrush appears in this Birds of the Adirondack. And he's with a friend. Wearied by our unsuccess, we at last turned homeward when suddenly the quiet was broken by the song of a hermit thrush. Louder and clearer it rang from the depths of the grim and rugged woods until the sweet, sad music seemed to fill the very air and to conquer for the moment the gloom of the night. Then it died away and ceased as suddenly as it had come. Perhaps the song would have seemed less sweet in the daytime, but uttered as it was, with such surroundings, sounding so strange and so beautiful amid these grand but desolate wilds, I shall never forget it.
It's wonderful. How old was he yes. when he wrote that?
It's since 1877.
He's 19.
He's in college. Yeah.
He's in college.
Listen, if we could get our college kids to write this prose, that would be terrific.
It's just beautiful, but you understand how many millions of words he's read to acquire that kind of a vocabulary.
That's right.
So you write early in the book that, quote, the boy read without prejudice or squeamishness. I was going to ask if you could talk about some of this really diverse childhood reading that he did and maybe how that influenced him as well.
Well, I said squeamishness because he read along with his sisters, and it didn't matter to him whether it was a book for girls or a book for boys. That's what I mean without squeamishness. So he would, even at the end of his life, when he was asking, as he was dying and he was asking for books, he was asking for books written by women, books you wouldn't, that would surprise you. A romance novel, for example. So that's what I mean. He read without prejudice or squeamishness. Whatever was out there for the family to learn, he wanted to learn.
And he read He read all the child's literature. He always read. He's a reader who doesn't make prior judgments about what he's reading.
Yeah, it's just very open-minded, even as a kid, and that just continued the rest of his life, it seems like. Well, you open your book with this, what I think is just a really telling line from T.R.'s autobiography that really gets to the theme of your book. I have always had a horror of words that are not translated into deeds, of speech that does not result in action. You write that Roosevelt made little distinction between thinking and saying, or saying and writing, or between writing and doing. I was going to ask if you could talk a little bit about that idea.
If words are important, and if words have meaning, and if words have power, and you can get into a situation where you have power, then your job is to use the words. And he certainly does that by the time he gets to the presidency. Often when we're talking about writers, we think of them sort of divorced from the world, of the physical world that Roosevelt lived in, of the gun and of the long walks and of the hunting trips on the Sound in bad weather. We think of them as sitting somehow in a room someplace and writing and imagining things. But for Roosevelt, the world, the physical world and the intellectual world and the scholarly world and the literary world were way more one than I think with most people.
That's interesting. And I like the way you put that.
And he demanded that language have power, right? And he knew how to give a political speech that was packed with power. It was often repetitive and it was often simple. He said platitudes and iteration are the substance of a political speech. Platitudes and iterations, right? Say it in the simplest, straightforward language you can invent, and then say it again, and perhaps later say it again, right? He wanted that language to make an impact on his listeners. The language they used to him or wrote to him made an impact on him, and especially when he was president, he could call up his buddies in the Republican Party and say, we need new law. It has to be language, and it has to do these things. And he was a brilliant legislator for that very reason, mm-hmm. it seems to me, because language and action go so much hand in hand. And if there is power in the letter of the law, it's because it's well written and it comes from important sources.
Mm-hmm. Not just words, but deeds as
well. Not just words, but deeds, right? And not just words, but binding words, legal words, new laws, new ideas in law. But we'll get to that later when he starts doing the national parks and the national reserves.
Right, right. So when we talk about turning deeds into words then as well, I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about his experiences in action and adventure that become the fodder for so many of his books. So could you talk a little bit about that, about how he turned these real life experiences into publications?
Everybody who knows Roosevelt knows that he lost his mother and his wife on the same day, on Valentine's Day. That's when he went to the Dakotas, and he became a rancher. He left his baby with his sister, and he went out there to try to figure out ways that he could heal. It worked for him to be in that physical, natural world. And he turned that into a couple of books. And those books about the Dakotas probably are the place to start. He created characters. He had this wonderful story that he told about someone had stolen his boat, and he was going to go down the river after the boat. And he was it was cold, and there was a storm, and he couldn't stop reading Anna Karenina. And so you have this kind of wonderful and very human story, where his life comes together with the natural world. The other story is about killing the animals. And I think that book is about how you deal with death. He had known that people who are living can suddenly be dead. And so he went out, I think, to kill the animals to understand death, or that boundary between life and death. And he writes those stories also.
Right. It's lovely stuff. It's lovely stuff. He writes beautifully, as we've seen and heard, and he tells a story that's really quite compelling, and it pictures in a very real way his movement into full manhood and away from grief, right?
Yeah.
They thought, the people out there, the Dakotas, as you might imagine, thought him a bit of the dude. Right.
So did Walt Whitman.
But he quickly convinced them that they better not mess with him, right? That he could hold his own, and he loved being there. He loved it. He loved the masculinity of the whole thing. He loved the hard work. What did he say to his sister, Corinne? I'm just home from 14 hours in the saddle. And I'm just writing you this quick note. I'm going to go get in the bathtub soon, right? I mean,
he did have a bathtub.
He did have a bathtub out there, right? And he loved it when she sent him.
Can only endure so much hardship.
You probably have talked to other speakers about this, but there was a question about where to put his presidential library, and it's now going in. You probably know more about it than we do, in Medora. And so for people who are interested in studying Roosevelt, you can read him, you can read his books, you can go out to the ranch, and you can see with your own eyes.
Right. Yeah.
That's right. That's a thrilling book for me.
The Badlands, well, depending, I suppose, on your taste in nature, but I loved being in the Badlands, and I love being on the Little Missouri River. I thought that was just perfectly splendid. And it lets you understand something about Roosevelt. That's true of most writers. If you go to where they lived and where they were shaped, oh man, it really, really lets you understand them in a different kind of a way.
Yeah, it's where he said the romance of his life began. I guess, really. And he seems to have never had an experience that he wasn't willing to turn into words then. Into publication. So, I mean, if you think of him as a war correspondent, he goes off to Cuba, and you get the Rough Riders out of that.
He, anything he did, he wrote about. He he took some ribbing for this, you know. He put himself in the middle of the action. He wasn't above doing that, as you know. And the humorist, Sir Finlay Dunne, had a character,
Mr. Dooley,
who would comment on Teddy Roosevelt, what Teddy Roosevelt said, the idea that they had to order more eyes for the book. And I think I said at one point, yeah, it took 23 of the offending pronouns to get him up the hill and another 23 to get him down. So that's he's great. There and he's in the scene. I kind of adore him because I still adore that little kid. But there he is, and he's in the natural world. He's on the biggest hunt he's ever been on. He will, in fact, kill a Spaniard. It was for him his top military moment. And as a writer also, it's about this idea of action into words and words into deeds. And so that war, it was a good place for him as a writer to continue these sagas. It's sort of a variant on his hunting tale.
Yeah, he wrote it when he got home, and it didn't take him long.
Writing for Scribner's magazines first, right?
That was typical of writers in his day. Edith Wharton did that. Certainly Jane Addams did that a lot to make money. So then he would collect the articles into books and make money two and three times. Yeah.
That was his best-selling book, Rough Riders. Apparently, a million copies had been sold of that book. And, right. So he was always writing for money. Right.
He was earning his real living as a writer then.
Right. His yes. Way. Right. That's right.
Well, and that's always been a nice metaphor, isn't it? Of earning your living. Right. He was living his living and earning it all at the same time. That's really nice.
We talked a little bit about that serialization in magazines, that process of dual publication. I guess you say that was a little more common. It's not as if TR invented that serialization, but it certainly profited by it.
Was in the book about Africa and the book about Brazil, what he did invent was writing the book while you're living it. Those weren't essays that he then later collected. Those were essays he was writing on the spot. And it put him under really terrific pressure, if you stop to think about it, right? As I say in one passage, what if nothing mm-hmm. happened, right? And he's got to write something. He's got a contract. He's got a contract with Scribner's. They're paying him a lot of money to write those chapters, and they're publishing them, and they've got a contract beyond that, that they're going to put those chapters together into a book in exactly the order that Roosevelt has written them, with no serious editorial changes. And he's doing it at the end of a long, exhausting day in the wilderness somewhere. I mean, it's really quite daring notion of how you write a book. Right?
And he never missed a deadline.
Right. They were there on time. They were ready to put into typeset, right? There were very minor editorial changes that needed to be made, right? I mean, that's a demonstration not only of his imagination, because he was imagining how all these experiences as he was living them would fit together, and his skill as a writer, and his sense that he was going to have an experience that was worth making a book about. And I think both those two books, the Africa book and Through the Brazilian Wilderness, if you were going to read something as a contemporary reader, both those books would be interesting to do.
Yeah, as you said, it's a very daring way to write almost without much editing, right? You're just putting it straight into serialization. And I think he wrote out everything longhand, right?
Mm-hmm. He wrote on a triplicate. He had there was a white cover and a blue cover and a yellow one. And he wrote with a pencil, so he had to press hard, right? Then he'd send them off, and a runner would take him to the nearest port, send them on the ship, and he would keep the yellow copy. And the white copy was for the printer, and the blue copy, the middle one, was sent in a separate package so that if something got lost, they'd still have one good copy. And he always kept a copy of himself. And now they're gone. We can't find them anywhere. It would really be fun to get your hands. I mean, as a literary scholar, that would be really fun to get.
Oh my, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask if you could discuss Roosevelt as the historian writer.
What I was amazed with Roosevelt is that, of course, he had the archives in New York right before him, but he also looked for other treasure troves of letters. And a lot of the research that he was doing was very much like the research we did for his book. That is to say, he was trying to learn as much as he could learn from the papers still available. So he was scholarly in that way, that we don't usually think of him that way. And then his stories about the West, as you know, feature the Boone and Crockett types, the men who came across the country. His idea was that all these people who had come from Europe, and they'd come from different backgrounds, when they got to the American soil, they become Americans, and that there's an American voice. And he's interested in those people who develop that voice and who lead that path.
Yeah, really, that the whole theme of winning in the West, that frontier spirit is what made us Americans.
And the way he put himself into the stories, at some points, he would have footnotes. So he would be talking about something that was happening in 1769, and he started writing footnotes from 1883. But all of a sudden, he would just show up in these things. He's an interesting character in that way. He doesn't mind being in the story. And all these stories about the West then validate his move to the Dakotas and what he was doing in Dakotas. So that the history leads to, I don't know if all roads lead to Theodore Roosevelt, but the histories lead to a figure very like the figure he meant to be.
And it's important to remember that in Roosevelt's winning of the West, it's not the West, it's not North Dakota, and it's not Montana. It is the Trans-Appalachian West, and he loved it. We looked at some of the manuscript of the book that's available in the Library of Congress, and his revisions are so typical of him, right? Most writers, when they revise, cut, eliminate. Roosevelt expanded. And so he'll have more sentences and it'll go around on the back and there's still more sentences. I don't know how the editors ever put it together, but in a life of language, he didn't believe in wasting any. I'll tell you that for sure.
Addition, not subtraction. That's how
yes,
it is.
Absolutely. Accretion. Let's get this bigger, right?
Yeah. Well, you talk a little bit about when he was researching the winning of the West, that there was one historian by the name of Draper who had collected a number of antiquarian sources, source information here. You had the ability, in those days to literally monopolize the source material, and Roosevelt goes to try to get access to some of this stuff, and Draper refused to share it with him because he was waiting until he had all of the facts in front of him. He couldn't put the story down until he had the complete set of facts. But how did Roosevelt differ from that?
Well, Roosevelt,
he wasn't.
Just I might be the person who doesn't want to give him up until I get all the dots and all the T's. Anyway, Roosevelt wasn't so interested in that. He wasn't kind of pedant in that way. He didn't mean to do each thing. He got into something and it grew for him and it became a story for him. So he didn't want this guy sitting on papers that could be used to tell a bigger story.
And one of the things he didn't like about the guy who was hoarding the papers, that you couldn't be fussy. You had a story to tell, a big narrative. And And that stands behind the energy of all of his later books, it seems to me, that compelling urge to tell the story by using the facts that enhance the story and maybe leaving the others out or acknowledging them, but not getting tangled up in, as Catherine was putting it, pedantry.
Yeah, that's interesting. That makes me think of why he also didn't pursue a major at Harvard as a naturalist, because that whole field was moving into the close dissection and what he called the microscopists. And so he desired to be more of a general field naturalist. And so I guess his feelings about history are no different.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And that's a bigger canvas. But yeah, to work on a microscope just wouldn't have suited a personality like that. I can't even imagine. He was a guy who was still trying to, he just figured out his glasses. But I think looking under a microscope was not of interest to him.
You quoted, maybe it's a passage from history as literature, but he says the writer must possess the power to embody ghosts, to put flesh and blood on dry bones, to make dead men living before our eyes.
Right.
Yeah. That's pretty much the heart of history as literature right there, right? Yeah.
But again, that makes him, we were talking about whether he's a literary figure, like would he have been a literary figure if he hadn't been president? People who write literature care about that very thing, about bringing people to life and making life recognizable, and that you can have a relationship through language with worlds quite beyond what you can see for yourself.
Well, moving on to different aspects of him as a writer, you note that Roosevelt produced 15 volumes of essays. I was going to ask if you could maybe talk about T.R. as an essayist, political philosopher, nationalist, polemicist. How's that different from some of his other writings?
Well, he's writing all the time, of course. But what irritated him is that somebody would write to him and say, we want you to write a political essay. He calls his writing socio-political. And so when he sits down to write, he doesn't want it to be something expected or assigned. He wants his mind to move, as it could move so wonderfully well, over a variety of issues.
And his political philosophy and his theories of history and whatnot are all very much of a piece, right? He sees politics as the art of the possible, and he has things he wants to get done, and he explains how they might get done in his writing, right?
A good speech to go and read, if people want a speech to read, is his Osawatomie speech. I think his words are still relevant. He was so good a politician that his ideas are still carried from venue to venue and revered and admired in ways that might please a modern reader, might interest a modern reader, depending on your politics, of course.
But we take Roosevelt seriously as a political thinker and as the builder of a party and as the rebel who led a third party candidacy, right? With some really brilliant ideas. Right. His political writings and those essays, you know, establish as a kind of baseline those ideas, and he works them out, and he works them out. And then he turns them into political speeches, which, as I say, deal with platitudes and iterations. Say it in the simplest possible language, and then say it again.
And many of those ideas from Osawatomie and then the Progressive Campaign are put into deeds, but it took another Roosevelt to complete some of those deeds, I think.
Some of those deeds, right, yeah.
But he had the right idea when he talked about the malefactors of great wealth. That's a powerful metaphor even today as we try to figure out who does the work and who makes the money. He was very interested in things like that and in fair play and you know, how you tax people and how you work people and how you pay people.
Square deal.
Even how many days you work a week and such. That square deal, yeah. He's very modern in that one. Did ask Jacob Riis, remember, who wrote How the Other Half Lives, to take him into New York and to show him what was happening. And he built law out of what he saw about the immigrant labor and the close quarters and how people managed to live just a basic life. And he was a man, let's remember, who inherited money. He came, as Edith Wharton did, and Jane Addams, too, from inherited money. They weren't people who had to work at all. And what's amazing about him is that he takes his work seriously, and he works all his life.
And was willing to learn from those experiences and adjust and apply it. Those.
And learn from writers like Jacob Riis.
And that's right. Right. Yeah.
Whereas you look at those writings as we were moving towards the First World War, I think you said he was becoming increasingly strident and bullying from the pulpit, I think is how you put it.
One of the historians we read characterized that period of his life and his writing as curdled charisma, right? And that's a pretty good metaphor, it seems to me. His good nature and his humor had pretty much vanished out of those writings, right?
He sent one of the war books to Edith Wharton, and he signed it From an American. And that, we haven't touched on that idea, but I don't know when we've had a president who's worried, who has worried himself about the nature of our culture and our literary voice in the way that he has. But he said, if when we're writing, we're copying Europeans, Henry James can write like a Britisher, big deal. He's not an American writer. And he's the only president I know who cared about defining American literature that way.
Right, yeah.
And so when he said he was an American, he meant, I'm not a British American. I'm not a French American.
I'm not a Dutch American.
I am an American.
Right. And if you're still trying to basically just ape some of the European tradition still, then you'll never be a great writer.
Right.
Yeah. He even said to Edith Wharton, who was trying to write a novel of manners about America, he also said to her, do New York. That's where the power is. So he was even advocating for Edith Wharton to write the American novel.
The American language should smack of the soil.
That's what he said.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It should arise out of our cultural life together. And in that, his language, although of an entirely different sort, is most similar to probably to Walt Whitman's and to that vision of American openness to new experience and new things, right? And they admired each other. Right? They admired each other.
Dante of the Bowery.
Yeah, he said, you know, Whitman, the Dante of the Bowery, right?
Dante
you know,
of the Bowery.
He can take that American life in the Bowery and turn it into poetry and real language, right?
That we have Whitman nothing to be ashamed of in our own traditions, right?
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly, right.
Could we look at Roosevelt as a correspondent? It's, I think, a very conservative estimate that he wrote 150,000 letters in his lifetime. What does all this correspondence tell us about him? And I was going to ask if you had some selections from his personal correspondence that kind of give us some insight into Roosevelt as a writer.
They are lively and pointed and beautifully written. And they have the wonderful sense that they're being dashed off, right? What, he doesn't go back and rewrite and straighten things out and whatnot.
What I always tell my students is that reading a volume of letters is as rewarding or more rewarding than reading a novel. Because when I was working with Jane Addams and she was writing to Tolstoy, they were really writing to her. They're real people in the letters. And I maybe I'm strange, but I can get quite excited about a volume of letters.
Yeah.
It gives you the satisfaction a novel gives you, that you have characters and they're talking together and they're talking about real things.
I have. Well, here's an example. The president had asked him to be the official American representative at King Edward IV's funeral. He got to England for the funeral after he had been around and talked to all the kings and queens and made his speeches at the Sorbonne and in Berlin and in Stockholm when he accepted the Nobel Prize. He came back to England and he was invited to G.M. Trevelyan's house where there were lots of people around, and he talked about his trips. And Trevelyan said, "That is so interesting. You need to write all this down to me in a letter." So Roosevelt said, "Okay, I've got some things to do when I get home." And he went home and he sat down and he wrote Trevelyan a 50-page letter about his adventures in Europe and detailed the sociology, the economy, the militarism of all these cultures. It's really a brilliant letter. And then he signed it off and said, "Thank you, George, here it is. You'll like it," right? But he hadn't made fun of anybody in that letter, right? And so he turned to another friend of his, an American, and he said, "I'm going to tell you what really happened at the king's funeral." Okay. And what follow are T.R.'s observations on the funeral dinner, which he describes in high comedy with an American sense of the absurdity of rank and royalty. "A virtual wake," Roosevelt designates it, "because I hardly know what else to call it. As soon as I entered the room, the Bulgarian Tsar came up to speak to me and thank me for various things I had done for the Bulgarians. He's a very competent fellow, but at the moment, all the other sovereigns were angry with him because he had suddenly christened himself Tsar instead of King, which they regarded as bumptious. Moreover, he had had an intricate row about precedence with the Archduke Ferdinand on the way to the funeral." Roosevelt delights in adding that squabble was as complicated and involved and utterly childish as the rows in Washington. And then the scene changes only slightly. "While I was talking to the Tsar, the emperor suddenly walked up to us, thrust himself in ahead of the Tsar, turned his back square to him and said to me, 'Roosevelt, my friend, I want to introduce you to the King of Spain.' Then, with a sudden ferocious glance over his shoulder at the Tsar, 'He's worth talking to.'" "The unfortunate Prince Consort of Holland was at the dinner. He came up and began to talk with me, but the emperor pounced on me again for some purpose, paying not the slightest heed to the wretched Prince George, who drifted off in fat meekness. The King of Denmark, a nice old boy, introduced me to his brother, the King of Greece, also a nice old boy." So it just flows like that. And that is really great, great comic writing. It just is. And you can see the twinkle in his eye as he's at this incredibly stuffy English funeral, right? Having some fun with it. I just love it. Yeah, I would say that as an informal correspondent, he's at his absolute best as a readable writer for us, right?
That wit really shines through in writing like that.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
I was going to ask if you could talk a little bit about any of those relationships with other authors and even journalists and how he got along with other authors.
He was not friends exactly, but he was an acquaintance of Mark Twain. Right. He was an acquaintance of Henry James. He was an acquaintance of Henry Adams. Both Henry James and Henry Adams had real reservations about his public persona. Twain admired him, but he was so much different politically and so much older, they couldn't really be friends. He was very good friends with Owen Wister, the writer of The Virginian. And Wister was taking, I think this is pretty much literally true. He was taking the kinds of storytelling that Roosevelt had done about the West, and he was turning it into long narratives. Everyone agrees that Owen Wister invented the Western as a genre, which then became the Western genre in the movies. And so you can literally kind of trace it back to Theodore Roosevelt's experience in the Dakotas, right? That's sort of the seed mm-hmm. where all this wonderful American mythology got its roots, right?
He got Owen Wister to, he wanted him to change a scene in the book. And it's Ernest Hemingway, I think, when he found out about that, was quite irritated that he would go in and try to make it a sort of nicer story than it was.
He and Owen Wister had been classmates, not in the same class, but they'd both been at Harvard at the same time. Owen Wister was a freshman when Theodore Roosevelt was a junior.
But they all know each other. That's a good way to put it. You know, Edith Wharton called Owen Wister Dan Wister. And when her play was supposed to open in Detroit, he was going to go with her. So there are all these letters that you can find sort of behind the letters if you know the relationships there are. And that's and so we found interesting things in those archives also.
Owen mm-hmm. Wister later.
It's interesting how Roosevelt grafts himself into that Western story. That frontier story with
that's
his own
Crafts
experiences.
Or Crafts or, no, he is the Western story. Yeah, but that's right. That's right.
Yeah. We had started to talk about this before when we were talking about winning the West. And I was thinking also with that story with the Rough Riders of Finley Peter Dunn, the satirist Mr. Dooley, how Roosevelt had this way of disarming his critics, with engaging them.
That is such a good point, because we live in a culture where everybody is angry right away, and there doesn't seem to be any bridge across the anger. But what happened when Mr. Dooley got done with him, I mean, everybody was howling. And so what he did was, instead of getting angry, is he wrote to Dunn and he said, well, you've given my family, you know, a great deal of enjoyment, laughing at me, making sport of me. And I think now you have to pay me back. And I think you need to come to the White House.
To dinner.
And so he invited him to dinner and they laughed together because he's put himself too much in the book. And what Dunn's character says is, well, if Titty had done it, he'd done it all by himself, I think he should just have called it Alone in Cubia. Which was wildly funny. Right. And Roosevelt, even that he was friend, knew it was funny. And then he could turn the joke around. And I think we would have a lot to learn from a political environment
right.
like that, where you're a strong enough figure that you can be laughed at and mocked, and then you can invite the guy to dinner.
Right, yeah.
I think that's right.
Another thing is that all his writing, in one way or another, is about character. Human character. And he insists that people have to have a strong character, which is what he has. He is enormously good-natured. He's forgiving. He's open. He's willing to be criticized. He's willing to criticize right back if that's what happens. It's quite a remarkable human personality that he is possessed of.
Yeah, his first work from the Badlands, Hunting Trips of a Ranchman, you know, that's his first attempt at hunter naturalist literature. And then it's criticized by George Bird Grinnell, the editor of Forest and Stream. And so rather than just being prickly about it and saying, well, I'll never have anything to do with him, he goes right to his office and confronts him on it. And
right.
they become fast friends and form Boone and Crockett Club together.
Boone and Crockett, it's quite remarkable, right?
Right.
And there's a book there, or two or three, to deal with that friendship would be a really intricate kind of a study, I think.
Has there ever been a president that was so widely read or deeply read, as Roosevelt, I wonder. Roosevelt had remarked that I'm a part of everything that I've read. And I was going to ask you about his reading habits, about how he read, what he read, his thoughts on these required reading lists and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, you know about the 10-foot library, and he thinks anybody who's stupid enough to think that if you read 10 feet of books that somebody else has chosen, that you're educated. That an education starts with, I love to say this in my classes, education starts with one book. And then you then fill in the rest of it. People talk about him as a speed reader, or he could look at something, have photographic memory. What I can figure out from what we were doing is he read, as everybody reads, at different speeds. And so sometimes things he could, political things, he could pick up and know. But he was also interested in reading slowly and savoring things. And he would read with his family in the evening. I don't know what families do that anymore, but you take your favorite scene from a book and you read it in the evening together. He read without, as I say, without squeamishness or prejudice. He read everything he picked up. When he was on the train and he'd stop at a newspaper stand, he read all the newspapers every day, but he would pick up every magazine. You know how you try to pick, oh, do I do this magazine or that magazine? He picked them all up. And then he'd read them during the day. He had this habit of tearing the pages when he was done with them, so he'd know, I guess, what he'd read. And so the floor would be just a mess in papers when he got done.
Some people thought that he treated the Library of Congress as his own personal library. Mm-hmm. And he would write to the librarian and say, send me books on Irish myth, send me books on Hungarian poetry, send me books on so-and-so and so-and-so. And then he'd write back in 10 days or so and said, I've read all those. I'm having them sent back to you. Send me some more of these. He often read when he was having a really hard time in the White House. He spent a lot of time escaping into books. He said at one time, I think, reading sometimes is almost a disease to me. It's obviously a neurotic response, right? But it all gets stored up here. And he was endlessly fascinated by the world of books. And he could read them, and if he had read carefully, he'd retain them. So that when he was making the tour of all the kings after he came home from Africa, he went to Hungary and impressed everybody there with his knowledge of Hungarian poetry. He said, I've never thought knowledge should or reading should be useful, but it came in handy to me when I got in the Hungarian court and I could talk about Hungarian poetry. I suppose that the central notion about all that is the pigskin library that he took with him to Africa. His sister gave him the books. She asked him what books he wanted to take with him. He told her. She had them trimmed and bound in leather. She had them put into an aluminum case. It's really quite beautiful. We saw it at Harvard one time, right? And it was Cervantes and Sir Walter Scott.
Twain. Yeah.
And Mark Robert Twain. Yeah. Lots of Twain. Lots of Robert Browning. Lots of Keats. 50 books. And they were there for 14 months in Africa. And after 10 months, they got to Nairobi. And he was delighted to get to Nairobi because they'd already read all the 50 books while they were hunting every day. And they went in and they bought 14 more. And he was very suspicious of somebody who said, you have to read this book. No, some books are good for other people and some are for me. I find my own way. All right. And you should too. If you're well-educated, you will. He had a table in the entryway of the White House, a very small table, and he always had a book on it, because while he was all dressed up to go out to dinner, he would have to wait there for Edith. And so he'd pick that book up, and he would stand there and read, so he wouldn't miss a minute. And when she'd come, he'd put it down, put it back on the table. But it was always there.
But when he was out in the car and driving around, too, he would be reading. So he had a life in language. That's true.
I came across a quote. He said that books are almost as individual as friends. yeah. which is a beautiful way of looking at it too.
That's a wonderful way.
And he'd come back to certain writers in the way that you would come back to friends.
So TR was always, you observe that he was always thinking about the place that he might have in American letters, and that if he'd never been president, that he might well be remembered as a literary man himself. So where do you see TR fitting within this American literary tradition?
Yeah, I think I made that comment myself. Well, you know, when you're teaching classes and you're looking for a roster of people to have to educate your students, I think he would fit neatly into a syllabus that would feature any of the turn of the century writers. You could slip a book in, and you could talk about what the political world had to offer literature, or I would teach literature that way. So that you would typically think of teaching a literature class, it's poetry and it's fiction and plays and such. But it seems to me that nonfiction has its place.
And I would emphasize, if I were back in the classroom, I would emphasize his environmental writing. And I'd put him in my course in environmental lit. I'd have some of the chapters of some of those books for the students to read so they'd understand where their mm-hmm. conservation values come from, right? Because that's the continuing importance and validity of Roosevelt, is in the shaper of our national value system, right? And he had an mm-hmm. enormous influence on that, and still does, and is still relevant in that way.
So at the risk of prescribing a book list, I was going to ask you if you had recommendations on which of TR's writings you would point the modern reader towards for pure literary enjoyment.
I think the ranch stories are a good place to start. As I said, I think the Osawatomie political speech is a good place to start. I think the essay, History as Literature, what he says about the importance of good writing is something we all need.
And I would say to read the Book Lover's Holidays.
That's right.
In
yeah.
the Open.
Yeah.
Is his last real sort of literary book. And it's an elegant and very interesting book with one of the very best prefaces or introductions that he wrote. That book would be nice. And then if you wanted to read one of his long nature writing adventure stories, Through the Brazilian Wilderness would be the one I would say. Mm-hmm. And you could read it with Candace Millard and Joseph Ornig at the same time, right? Because his version of the adventure is so much different than theirs. Right?
But there's one part of his autobiography called Indoors and Outdoors?
Outdoors and Indoors.
Outdoors and Indoors. and I think that that's a good place to start, too.
There's some beautiful prose in there.
There really is. We went to Sagamore Hill, and that's the indoors in that book. And it's a wonderful place. Maybe that's what I'd say. Go to Sagamore Hill and stand there and look at that study and then look at the whole thing and then start reading, because you'll find him as fascinating as that house.
There'll be things you don't expect to find. They'll be wonderful. Yeah.
Could I perhaps ask you to close the episode here with reading from the last page of your own book?
Okay. A great man had died, and the world knew it.
Accounts of that death, the funeral, the posthumous tributes are well known.
Here we note Roosevelt's loss to the literary world that he so dominated.
He was a man of letters, of language, a spokesman for the human imagination expressed in words. A tireless reader of those words himself, a believer, finally, in language in all its forms.
In his world, words, as he insisted until the end, always led to action, and action well taken always led to words.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Wish we could do it as Roosevelt, but we can't.
I'll let you work on that for our next episode. That's
sweet.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good. Good afternoon. Thank you.
Really appreciate you taking the time to chat.
It was fun.
Pleased to be with you.
What a great conversation with Professors Thomas Bailey and Catherine Joslin, authors of Theodore Roosevelt, A Literary Life. As I said earlier, this is truly one of my favorite books on TR, a real pleasure to read. If you really want to understand Theodore Roosevelt, you should know what he wrote and how he wrote and how his lifetime of reading informed his strenuous life. And no single volume written on TR, I think, provides better insight into this aspect than Theodore Roosevelt, A Literary Life. To our Talk About Teddy podcast audience, I'd say your TR library is incomplete without this book. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening.
You can find this podcast on our website, talkaboutteddy.com, where you can see show notes and transcripts, links to resources, and additional TR content. And please tell us what you think.
If you've enjoyed our content, please consider subscribing and reviewing the podcast wherever you listen, and tell your friends and family about us, because it really does make a tremendous difference and it helps others find this show.
We hope you'll join us for the next episode of Talk About Teddy. And until then, as our friend Colonel Roosevelt would say,
do what you can with what you have where you are.
Bullet.